Welcome to episode 389 of Radio Free Nintendo. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
Hello, party people.
We can hear you this time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we can hear
don't,
you.
Don't worry. This time, we're good.
Yeah, we could hear you last time as well. It's just
yeah, we don't. Yeah, we can't confirm or deny that John Lindemann will be making an appearance in this episode yet.
Of course, you also heard there James Jones.
I am eternally doubtful of John Lindemann's capacity to record audio.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Well, I sure hope everyone's recording their audio because I'm, yeah. Otherwise, I'm just through with this shit.
Hey, guys. Hey, whoa. Actually, let's stop right there for a second.
What?
No.
Are you joking?
Hello!
Not funny.
Jeez. Okay. Well, guys, we have some listener mail coming up later in the show, but first up, as always, is new business, and James is going to kick off a rather odd menagerie of video games that we have for you this week.
Yeah, it's kind of a hodgepodge this week. Last week was the Shovel Knight Love Fest, sort of preluded by Guillaume's opportunity to play it the week before. Basically, I've finished up that, and in the interim, I've been playing Super Mario 3D World, which I got right before we went to E3. It was on sale at Best Buy for like $10 off. So it was the price where I'm actually willing to buy games the majority of the time, that $50 sweet spot. I was excited for the game, but not, you know, I didn't need a Mario in my life at that moment. I know what I said. I know I did it on purpose. So when I came back from E3, I sat there and I burned through the first four worlds in the sitting and thought, oh, this is Nintendo, you need to do better than this. And I mean, we've talked about this game on the show a lot, so there's not a whole lot of ground for me to cover, but I was really impressed by how the game does kind of finally open up after the first few worlds, and I felt like, okay, I'm getting into this. I enjoyed some of the inventive level stuff they did. I thought it was a nice transition from the very narrow platforms of 3D Land and how they've adapted the kind of gameplay to, or they adapted the world design for multiplayer gameplay. I think they've done a lot of things with hiding stuff that works really cool.
You know, I think they also ramped up the speed of movement quite a bit in 3D.
Yeah, it
world,
is. It is faster. Definitely.
I think it makes a big difference when you're playing solo, and this might have even come from E3 conversation. I don't know, but you know, like there was a lot of concern that the levels being wider and larger to accommodate four players would kind of make it feel too big for a single player. And I think they largely avoid that problem just by having you move faster than as compared to 3D Land. I feel like Mario and the other characters have a little more steam, and I feel like, I don't know, the game feels a little bit better paced, or at least the individual levels seem a little better paced in this one.
Yeah, I mean, their literal second gear they have when you're running is definitely faster than anything 3D Land has. And
the cat suit is, you know, even much faster than that.
Right. It is a little bit reckless once you start throwing the cat suit and top speed in there.
And playing as
and
Toad.
That's what I want. I want it to feel like maybe I shouldn't be running this fast, but I've got places to be. So, yeah, it's around World 5 I start to feel like the game sort of felt better. I enjoyed the fact that they've gone and said, we're not going to repeat bosses a bunch of times. I think you fight Spike once, and I can't remember what the female generic Bowser kin is, the one with the boomerang, but I think you only fight them maybe twice each.
They do, and, yeah, only twice. They do better
well,
with
versus
the bosses.
3D Land, where it was all the time.
Yeah,
I know, and the Galaxy games have that problem. But, you know, I do think they have improved in the boss repetition, but one of my very few complaints about this game is that they actually repeat levels later on.
And
that really turned me off. That really made me not excited to try to get everything, and I didn't. You know, I played through those. I got a star, a couple stars, whatever, but, you know, I wasn't, like, going back and trying to obsess over them and get every single little thing, because I was like, nah, I've done that once already in the other one, so.
I think some of the stuff that they did with some of those levels was really cool. I thought some of the stuff they did with other ones was really just not interesting.
Lame. Like it makes it way harder, but not in a very creative, interesting right. way.
There was a ghost house in, I think it was like the Fire Flower set of worlds. That's a very, very much the same ghost house as was in like World 6, but they require you this time to understand that if you stand on the sofa, you're going to get taken to other parts of the level, which in World 6, all that did was get you to a green star. But in fact, when you hit the end of that stage where the flag should be, there's no flag. And I thought that was very kind of inventive because you probably just shot through this level because you know where most secrets are. And then all of a sudden, oh shit, where's the end of the level? And there's just this infinite loop of this warp block that takes you back to the last room. You just keep doing it over and over again. And eventually, one of my favorite things about the game, which is when you make noise, everything in the world reacts to it because the Wii U obviously has a microphone in the gamepad. And I like that as I'm making noise playing the game, that things in the game are reacting and that it will reveal little secrets. And ultimately, that's how I beat the level. I basically was muttering to myself about where the fucking flag was, and I saw the clouds, the little clouds you could stand on, kind of ghostly outline. I was like, oh, they're over here. So the more angry I get, the more the game is going to show me its secrets. I'm okay with this. And I just followed it around and beat the stage. I mean, I like these little touches that they've said, okay, we've got this microphone. We're not really going to use it heavily, but let's put something in there that at least acknowledges that the user has it and that the game is reacting to them in some larger way than simply what buttons they're pressing. Well, I thought that was a cool little detail.
I don't think I had even noticed that the microphone could be used that way. I mm-hmm. know that in some levels, like it was very obvious that there were, like when there's mini Goombas, you can blow them away, or
right.
when there's like pollen falling from the sky, you can kind of guess, okay, they want me to blow in the mic, but I
so didn't... when you make noise, like even things like the coins will spin.
Right.
So there's all kinds of these little visual things they do just from, oh, the microphones make hearing noise, let's react to it.
Yeah, I don't think I was aware of that either.
I thought that was a really nice little touch, and I recognize that a lot of people probably wouldn't even notice it was happening, but the fact they put it in there, and they probably made the same realization when they put it in, I appreciated. I was like, yeah. Okay, that was a little bonus thing if you noticed it, and I really liked that. That was cool.
So, James, I don't know how much of 3D World you've played through so far, but
everything but the last level.
Okay,
the one you have to unlock.
Yeah, which I got that far too, I'm never gonna do it.
I did like how they handled the Bowser boss battles. I thought those were really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Very different every time. I enjoyed some of the new power ups they put in the game. I thought I don't remember what they call it, but essentially it's the block that's sort of like the propeller block or the coin block, but it shoots out cannonballs. I thought that was kind of a fun thing. And a lot of times how they incentivize you to keep it throughout the level by hiding stars behind breakable walls. I thought that was really fun.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
You're kind of walking with the crutch, but you need to keep the crutch the whole way.
Yeah.
I haven't got a chance to play multiplayer yet. I should this weekend, and I'm looking forward to that opportunity because I think it's going to be... I expect I'm going to lose all of the lives I have left at this point.
Sure.
Yeah. And I mean, I lost a lot of lives in those late unlocked levels.
Mm-hmm.
But I expect that I will lose all of those lives in very quick succession.
That's a good expectation. And if it's good to kind of resign yourself to that so you don't get annoyed at whoever you're playing with. But I found that I only tried it with a few people maybe, but I found that everyone I tried to play with was able to pick it up and be competent pretty quickly. And if you know, we would go and play levels I'd already cleared. So I wasn't concerned right. about finding the stamp, and I wasn't concerned about finding all the little secrets. It was mostly about, let's just try to get to the end. And to that end, I think it speaks a lot for the game design by Nintendo, that it seemed like the average person who, like, you know, has played video games but not necessarily very much 3D Mario, which is a very kind of specific kind of game, it seemed like they were able to get to the end of the levels. Even when we got into some of the harder levels, they struggled with a little bit and they might have died once or twice. But in general, like, yeah, they were able to pick it up. And I think if you can go in with that attitude, and I don't think it's condescending, it's just I'm going to play this game differently than I would by myself, you know? It's like, we're going to have fun, we're going to laugh, we're going to get in each other's way, we're both going to die, and it's okay, and we don't have to care about anything in this level other than let's have fun, let's try stupid things, and let's make sure we get to the end. And, like, I was surprised that the game was actually balanced well enough to make that work in multiplayer. Even though, as a single player, if you're trying to obsess over those secrets, it can be infuriating.
Sure.
Know?
And I expect that the majority of the deaths will come from just assholery. Because, I mean, just, yeah, just looking at how that game works, it seems custom built to troll the crap out of the people you're playing with.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, a lot of the power-ups will just straight up wreck people as you're trying to get through it. So I expect to be highly amused by the outcome of that experience.
You can also fight a little bit over which direction to go, because at some point the camera will choose someone to
choose
sort of
a winner.
Focus on. Yeah, and I don't really know how that works. Maybe it has something to do with the crown. Maybe it has to do with who has the most coins or who's in controller slot one. I'm not sure how that's decided, but I can remember quite a few times where we would get into these sort of subtle arguments about, you know, which path to take. And it felt usually like the game just sort of eventually chose one person and the other kind of got bubbled up and warped over there, you know, and now the choice has been made.
I used to know, it's been too long since I played this game. I used to know what makes the camera follow you. I think it's the crown. It's probably the crown.
If it's the crown, that's actually pretty great. Mm-hmm. You know, like they never explain that. You'd have to figure it out by observation. But, you know, the crown is this weird, and James, you haven't seen this yet. It only pops up in multiplayer, but it's this weird sort of MacGuffin that shows up after a couple levels and it tracks who's doing better, but you can steal it from the other person. And it doesn't appear to have any effect on gameplay. It's just bragging rights, but you carry it around with you and the other person can always see it. And if it also sort of subtly affects camera movement, I think that's actually pretty awesome. But we should test it.
I will say
I'm sure we'll hear from someone listening.
I was happy with some of the bonus levels and obviously the same concern you had that some of them are just reskins that don't really add anything. But I was happy with the game's difficulty later on. And I say happy is a relative term. I was enraged with the game's difficulty at some points later in the game. I think that I did make the horrible decision of I'm frustrated with this late level of Shovel Knight. Let's go play this late level of Super Mario 3D World. This will help me relax. And that's not a winning strategy, I'm going to say.
Oh, it's a different kind of action. So, I mean,
it might at least
annoy you in different ways.
Yeah, and there is that. It's a different experience, but God, my blood pressure must have been high by the end of game sessions. I would say 3D World can be infinitely more stressful because there's this.
Scrolling levels, especially in bonus land.
I feel like the checkpoints also aren't positioned right a lot of times. Like there'll be a checkpoint 5 seconds into the level, and then everything else is after.
Yeah.
And you sit there thinking, oh my God, why? Why did you do this to me, game? And you have to just run through it and try not to die. I feel like that was this incredibly stressful moment of you're standing on a block floating in space and there's a green star that if you line up the boomerang just right, you'll get it, but there's fire spitting piranha plants everywhere who want to take you out. It's like, do I need to go now or can I wait for this thing to come back? It's really just this constant, oh my God, 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 oh, damn it. Versus Shovel Knight, where there's no time to really think about the recriminations of your actions. You just have to go. And you're just going. And when you screw it up, you become aware of the fact you can screw it up once the screw up happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can usually anticipate it in Shovel Knight, but I don't feel that game really pushes you forward all that much. I mean, you're talking about go, go, go. But to me, one of the things I kind of like about Shovel Knight is that you can play it as slowly as you want. There's no timer. There's no limit on the number of deaths you can have. So it's a game. I go into a room and I kind of like to study the room and sort of plan out how I'm going to do it. And I feel like, you know, I can really take my time with it. And that helps me avoid getting frustrated by the more difficult parts. Cause I feel like I can go up there and in most cases, they don't link too many, hurdles in a row without a chance to kind of stop and take a break. Right. You know, like every now and then you'll kind of have to do two or three actions in a row and you kind of have to do them perfectly before you can proceed. But in Shovel Knight, I feel like it's mostly sort of isolated things. And especially because it's broken up into screens, there's usually a safe spot where you enter a screen or at least at the exit from the previous one. So like you can kind of calm down and approach things more thoughtfully than you can. Whereas in Mario, a lot of times there's things sinking out from underneath you, or the screen is literally just scrolling and you have to keep up, or you're on some kind of moving platform that's going over lava and you know, things are just being thrown at you constantly. There's right. a lot it's more a, of that in Mario.
It's a much more of a constant wear on you.
Yeah.
For Shovel Knight, a lot of the stuff I just intuit immediately when I enter the room. Oh, I need to do this. And I don't really have to think about it. I just go through it. It's the minute execution that gets me.
Yeah.
And it's when you have a long chain of minute execution points that you have to get off between save spots that is, if I hit them all, I don't feel like I accomplished anything. I just did it and I don't even think about it.
Yeah.
But it's when I miss one and go all the way back to the start that the clock starts on, oh no. Oh, it's going to be one of those times, isn't it?
Well, it throws you off your game. You know, if you kind of felt like you were in a groove and you were making a lot of progress, you went through two checkpoints without dying once, and then you finally hit this one place where the timing is just a little strange. Like, you're supposed to kind of stutter step before you move on, you know, or there's something weird about the timing.
Or you just jack up a jump. I mean, a lot of times for me, it was just – I just straight up just missed.
I don't know about you guys, but in Shovel Knight, I found that typically anywhere that I died, I probably died multiple times. I don't know if it was just messing up my rhythm of play or if those are just the hard parts and everything else seems relatively easy, but there were almost no places in the game, including bosses, where I died exactly once. That almost never happened.
But also the spots where you die, you lose treasure that you can recuperate.
Right, so you end up getting slowed down trying to reclaim them. Yeah.
That's what happened to me. I was just like, well, I've got a shot here to just, you know, not lose any progress at all.
Yeah. Sometimes the trick was just going, yeah, that shit's gone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone forever and I'm not getting it back. And
I've gotten to the point where it's very easy for me to just not worry about the treasure because I've bought everything I want to buy in the game. I mean, there's more armor I haven't got, but you can only wear one suit at a time. And I've got the only one that I think I care about. So
I assume it's the knockback one.
No, I got the Dynamo.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really handy on bosses. You can pogo on them a couple times, and then if they throw up a shield or something, or they move, then you can come down to the side of them and lay in like a big charge shot.
Yeah, I never had an issue with the bosses. So
it also looks cool. It's big and silver.
Yeah.
Right. I got the gold suit, I never looked back.
Gold
and
suit?
You get, well, yeah.
It doesn't do anything, which is gold.
Yeah, it just, and also your gems are more acrobatic. I think it's pretty cool.
Oh, really?
Style points for Guillaume.
Yeah.
I mean, that suit is literally just style points. It actually says that basically in the game.
Yeah. At the end, you get a neat little bonus if you manage to finish the game with it and fulfill a certain requirement.
Really? Mm. Okay.
Yep.
Well, anyway, we've talked enough about Shovel Knight and 3D World, so let's move on. We'll come back to James at the end because he's got another kind of curiosity. But let's move on to Guillaume, who's playing a game that we all know pretty well.
All know and love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I am currently playing through Xenoblade. And I got this game, you know, for the first time all the way back when it was an import only and it hadn't been announced for North America yet. And I played for about 15 hours and I kind of got stuck at some place. I think it was at the bottom of the mine, so it was not really all that far into the game, and I think
that's right when you first get your third party member or thereabouts.
Yeah, like it's soon after that, and
yeah, it's pretty early.
Yeah, and it's one of those, like, you fight this Zord guy who you must absolutely use the chain attacks to defeat him, and maybe I skipped a tutorial or something, but I remember having a really tough time beating him, or actually I'm not sure if I even managed to back then, so I kind of stopped playing the game then, and then the game got announced for North America, and then I again played for like about 15 hours. And
so you did start from scratch?
Yeah, I started from scratch. Like, you know, I played the import on the hacked Wii. There's probably tools that you can download on a hacked Wii to convert save files, but I did not spend the 30 minutes to figure it out in order to save 15 hours of gameplay.
So are you playing a North American copy now?
Yeah, I'm playing a North American copy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I made it all the way back to where I was, and then I made it past that, and what's cool is that it allowed me to play the game in a different way than I had the first time. Like, the first time I didn't really experiment, this time I was like, well, I remembered getting my ass kicked by this boss, so I was like, well, let's do more quests, and let's try to take more of my time before reaching this point in the game, and let's actually try digging into the various menus and stuff. So I'm now doing things that I don't think I even looked at initially when I played the game, like the whole trading items that you pick up between party members to raise their affinity, to make them like each other more. You know, that allows you to access more story scenes and to be more useful in combat, I think, perhaps. Maybe
a little
not.
Bit, yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
I think that you can link more abilities between them, and so that's an advantage. So I've been doing a lot more of that. Like the whole collectopedia thing where you just basically have a scrapbook of doodads that you collect. When you fill up a page or a category, then you get special rewards. And I'm also getting addicted to doing the side quests, which is weird because usually in an RPG, I'll do a couple of them and then I'll just forget about them because they're a little bit too time consuming and I just want to get to the end of the game as fast as I can. But in this case, you know, I wanted to level up without grinding too much. So I'm spending more time talking to the villagers in various towns and doing the quests for them. And I'm kind of enjoying it. And that's really surprising me. Like the quests usually start out really stupid, like, like two kids fighting and you have to collect something to make them make up or whatever. But then you'll get another quest, like the mom of one of the kids wants you to get something for her to have an item repaired, and then you find the guy who can repair the item, and then turns out that he wants to date this mom. So you do a quest for him, and then like all these people have all these connections, and it's really really silly. It's really really stupid, but it does help make.
I think it kind of fleshes out the world, really.
It does, and you get a little bit more attached to the towns themselves, you know? Like, yeah, you feel like you've got more and more of a stake in seeing these people do well and be happy, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's also, it's useful in that, you know, you're going to have to do some grinding at some point in Xenoblade. And
right.
There are different options and different ways of kind of approaching that requirement, but I think, you know, especially early in the game, doing these side quests is one of the nicer ways because they're all, you know, fairly trivial in terms of there's not a ton of story attached to them. It's kind of a few text boxes, but it does. I mean, you tend to have to go out and fight monsters and go gather things, right, to finish the quest. So you're mm-hmm. going to do some of the same things you do even if you're just out aimlessly wandering. But then you also get a little bit of story. You probably get some affinity from completing the quest. And a lot of times they'll reward you with golden items, don't they, when you turn it in?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. But there's so many, I don't know, I'm not really into loot-type games. I'm getting way more items than I need, and most of the time these items that I'm getting, they're not necessarily better than the ones I already have equipped. I find the menus in this game really time-consuming, you know? Like, you've got to waddle through
yes.
pages and pages of swords, and then pages mm-hmm. and pages of battle pants. I'm going to call them battle pants.
Well, and at they some are point, it, frankly, pantsiest. It's worth selling off the old stuff, because
sure.
it's never going to be useful later on at all.
Right. And then
and
you've
even
got
if you
like
you don't get much money for it, at least you can clear out the menu and shorten the process.
Well, and
a little bit.
And you usually do get decent money for them.
Sure, sure. But there's like so many different types of items like that. You have to sell items one by one. You can't just press like one button to select multiple items in one
right.
shot and sell them all, you know? And then
yeah.
so okay, you've sold all the swords, now you're gonna sold all the battle pants.
I guess I was just doing it very regularly, so it never really was a big deal. It was usually, I was never selling more than two items.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are certain items, like the gems, I thought, well, you know, like I'm going to collect those, and at some point my affinity between characters are going to be high enough that it's going to be worthwhile to craft gems. and then, you know, like it's going to pay off. But it turned out not really to be that way. You have way more gems or crystals or whatever than you can actually insert in the slots of your equipment. And it's kind of a chore to install and uninstall gems based on what you need at a certain time, you know. So what I'm doing is just, okay, I'm going to get me these best gems and I'm going to assign them to these weapons and this armor, and then I'm not going to touch it for a couple of hours. So in the meantime, I'm collecting items from all these enemies that I'm killing, and it just adds up. And yeah, so I don't know. There's so many menus and stuff. It's not really my favorite aspect of the game.
It mm-hmm. could be streamlined a lot. And I guess we didn't see, James, when we were watching the Treehouse thing, we didn't really see a whole lot of the sub-menus that
No, because they never – well, A, they were in Japanese, and B, they only went in there that one time to show you, yes, there are menus. Go ahead and equip that dagger.
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem in every RPG, MMORPGs, anything like this where it's you just keep getting loot over and over again.
I don't know that it's a problem. I like getting loot. I like getting this item and saying, is it going to help me? No. All right. Mm. Cash money, son!
Well, inventory management is always an issue. Just making it non-tedious.
It becomes almost its own mini game.
I would say, though, that one thing this game does that alleviates that problem is there's no limit. You can just basically just keep holding shit.
Oh, it's not like
game. That part of what contributes to it becoming a little overwhelming, though, James. I mean, one of the nice things about limits is that they do force you to make choices about what to carry.
Yeah, but then you're sitting there with this item you found in a dungeon, like, well, I don't want to throw anything out. All the stuff I have, I want to keep. That sucks. Right. I don't like that.
But actually, there are limits. Like, there are maybe, like, you can have 3 pages of swords and you can have 10 pages of gems.
Okay, that's basically that's a lot of fucking swords.
Well, I reached that point pretty quickly.
You shouldn't have 3 pages of swords. You fucked up if you have 3 pages of swords.
You probably have a lot of repeats in that case.
Yeah, sure, but that's because I'm battling a lot of enemies. I'm trying to collect these items to finish these quests, you know? Like I have collected a lot of stuff because the game asks you to collect a lot of crap, you know?
Well, swords, not 3 pages of swords, man.
Yeah, but I mean, to Guy's point though, that's a problem that there should be a way to get around that. I mean, you should be able to do something like spawn a little creature that you can sell stuff to on the road. Right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Like, there's ways around that stuff.
You can teleport wherever you want in this game.
I mean, sure. Yeah, but why should you have to get out of the world? Why should you have to, like, get out of what you're doing just to go back and sell inventory? That sucks. No one wants to do that.
Yeah. I would say that's the least... In this game, of all the RPGs I've ever played, that is the least of an issue in this game.
Yeah, you're both right. I mean, yes, John, it should be something that is more even more convenient than it is. But to James's point, if you haven't played a lot of Xenoblade, it's hard to understand just how crazy useful the fast travel is. Because fast travel in a lot of games, it's something where there's like very limited places you can go, and a lot of times you just have to do a lot of traveling even after you warp to it. Or there's some penalty, you have to spend magic points, or it's a special item, or they take something away. But in Xenoblade, I mean, you can do it everywhere, and the list of where you can teleport to is really detailed.
It's dumb. It's just dumb.
You can drill down several levels deep of like locations that you want to go to.
Yeah, and apparently I've just learned that apparently I've been traveling around the dumb way for this whole time, because when you press minus on the control pad, it brings up a map where you can travel anywhere in the area that you're in. But you can't just travel to another area. But if you go through the menu, apparently you can go choose the area.
I've never understood that.
I had the same problem.
Because I explained on this show to you how to get to the other map.
Yeah, indeed, but it's been a while. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
It's worth reminding people if they're just discovering the game now.
Right.
There's 2 maps. I don't know why there's 2 maps, but there are 2 fucking maps.
But yeah, other than spending too much time in the menus and wishing that there were, you know, an easy way to just optimize the equipment that your characters have, I've been having a lot of fun, and I'm playing as the other characters, which I hadn't been doing. You know, I had been playing as Shulk for my first playthrough the whole time, and I didn't really see a need to switch.
Shulk is stupidly powerful, so yeah, it's hard to justify switching.
Right, but then I did switch, and it turned out to be better than I had anticipated, because pretty much all the characters have some way to initiate a break, as it's called. Like, basically the whole system, your fighting system, you're trying to you know, first have an attack that breaks the enemy's guard or whatever, and then you topple them, and then you daze them. So that's the...
It's like combo building at a fighting game.
Right.
I mean, you're trying to make sure you line up, and there's some strategy in, okay, I'm going to select this person's attack so that on the next turn, I can use this other... Or for the next person, I can use this attack or this skill, and they sync the right way to continue the combo.
Right. So I've been using that, you know, and it's even color-coded. Like, you choose the pink skill, and then the yellow skill, and then the green skill, and... Basically, if you can master that, you're set.
Yeah, it's very straightforward, but there is a lot of mental strategy in. Okay, I've got two choices here, but if I use this one, it's going to make it harder on the next go around of turns to get it right.
So I've been having a great time, even playing through the areas that I've already seen. You know, just by experimenting more and trying different characters. It's I don't know, doing the side quests has been really relaxing. Like, it gives me the same kind of feel as playing Wind Waker back in the day, where you're just sailing around and finding something, and then, okay, maybe I can do something here. And exploring, there's not really much of a threat to you in most places. And
until occasionally you run into a place that there is, and it's kind of cool.
Right, yeah. So yeah, like, very, very... I don't know. It's a very peaceful game when you're admittedly overleveled for the area that you're in. But I've been enjoying it that way.
It's a very complete world. And if you walk through the woods in real life, you're pretty much going to be safe. But you might eventually run into a bear. And that's pretty much what this game is. You're probably pretty safe walking around.
Right. Until a giant ass spider comes out.
But occasionally
someone's
going to come along
that
wants to fuck you up. And you need to be aware of that. And you need to stay away from him. Because he will do it.
Yeah, and the areas are just like, they keep getting more and more fantastic. Like, it's funny because right after the mine, you enter a swamp, and I'm like, oh great, a fucking swamp. You know,
oh,
like
this
is
amazing.
Right. Like, I thought, okay, so this is this RPG's version of sewers. Because RPGs just love making you explore sewers. But then, you know, that was in the daytime, and then nighttime comes along, and all of a sudden, everything just lights up, and there's, you know, fantastic
bioluminescence stuff in all the trees.
Yeah, and it was like, wow.
The first time you're in the swamp, and it takes a couple days worth of game time to move from one end of the swamp to the other. And obviously deliberate, because they want you to have that experience of that first night in the swamp.
Right.
Because stuff gets real, real freaky at night, too. There's lots of things out there that want to kill you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So at night, your best strategy really is to just sort of hang out in a place that's safe and just sort of wait out the evening. Hmm. And the game is giving you all this visual stuff that's like, wow, this is really fantastic. And I can just sort of appreciate. I think the music changes at night to something really kind of dramatic versus usually with the night music in that game is real calm.
Actually, it's kind of like piano. It's kind of calm.
Hmm.
Anyway, it's a very nice area. And
yeah, there's is. A your like, next the next area you're going to is the moment where I went, oh my god, in this game.
Yeah, actually, I've entered past a certain wall, and it's pretty cool. It's a more tropical area, and
there's a spot in the swamp that you can totally miss unless you're doing a side quest that directs you there. And in the swamp somewhere, and I don't even know how I found it the first time. I think I followed the quest marker. There are these ruins that are way, way, way off the beaten trail.
Right.
And they're kind of amazing.
And it's just, you know, I'm not spoiling anything. Like, you're on the back of a giant, right? So to get to the swamp, from the swamp to the jungle, you go through the giant's trachea.
Yeah, because you're on the path to his head.
Yeah.
So you're trying to get to the top of his head.
Yeah.
Which is the Arctic zone, because, of course, because you're higher up in altitudes. It kind of makes sense, and at the same time, it's kind of like, well, this is really nuts.
Yeah, so awesome. Just an awesome RPG. I'm really enjoying it, and it's pretty much unlike anything I've played before.
Yeah,
so
I got to pick this guy back up.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, John,
I really have to, man. Yeah.
You played it, like, very little, didn't you?
Yeah, but now I have the time to actually set aside and go and run through it, you know?
Yeah, and it's like, there's so much MMO in this, even though not an MMO. But like, if you're used to that especially, I feel like you're going to fall into it very easily, smoothly.
I mean, it really, the thing is, it really is an MMO. You're just not playing it online with other people.
Well, and it's much more interested in telling you a story.
Yeah, the storytelling. Yes, absolutely. The storytelling is like sometimes a little over the top, but like
I thought, you know,
still, I was really shocked at how interested I got in the story, because in the early goings it felt really cliched to me, but that story goes places and it does some really cool things.
And some of those characters are actually legitimately compelling. And yeah, even characters that when you meet them, you think this guy's an asshole, and then as you get to know them, like, you know what, no,
yeah. Yeah, the characters really grew on me, but for me, mostly it was just
and it's always Ryan time. Always. At all times, it is Ryan time.
No, Ryan is not in my party anymore.
You are fucking up, sir. Having Ryan in the party is the best, because when he's not screaming, it's Ryan time, he's making passes at Charlotte. It's amazing.
Actually, my favorite playable character doesn't show up until pretty late in the game.
All right, well, maybe we'll talk about it again.
No, it's not even Ricky. All right, so let's move on to my new business, and it's not the most interesting thing in the world, maybe, but I've been playing a shitload of Rezogun this week. Well, relatively speaking, maybe a couple hours. This PS4 launch title, which I actually got for free on Plus, which is incredible because I think it is still my favorite PS4 game. But the game really hadn't been updated or hadn't done anything with it since launch, which was, you know, 9 months ago almost. It's been quite a while. And this past week they did a patch update for everybody, which improved the score mechanics, I think. It reset the leaderboards, which is a little bit annoying maybe, but they kept some of the high scores in some kind of Hall of Fame legacy board or something like that. But for for the most part, they reset all the high scores, which, you know, it's kind of fun to go back and set new ones, but at the same time, it's like, well, but it's because they had changed the game so much that you couldn't really compare old scores and new scores. It wouldn't have made sense to mix them up. And I understand that. They added a ship editor, which is goofy, but some people seem to really like it. I mean, you can make a 3D model out of voxels. So if you've ever wanted to do that, now you can do it. That is kind of cool. The more interesting thing is they added a DLC, which I think is $5, but I paid like $2 extra to get the season pass because they're going to do more of this stuff. And I love Rezogun. And, you know, I think buying season passes before a game even comes out is very ill-conceived. But after the game is out and you already know that you love it and they're just now starting to do DLC and they say there's going to be more, no problem, especially when it's barely any more expensive than just the first pack. I was like, yeah, of course, I want all the Rezogun you could possibly give me. And the new DLC pack, they've only done the first one now, but it has two new modes in it. So there's a survival mode, which, you know, could have been ultra simple and not that interesting. I mean, it is kind of a cool idea. This is a very arcadey game, and one of the things people complained about when Rezogun first came out is that it is broken up into these levels. And they have a certain rhythm, but at the same time, the game is a finite length, the levels are a finite length, and you don't have the opportunity, like in a game like Geometry Wars, to just go as long as you possibly can and try to get the most ridiculous score that anybody's ever seen. That's a big part of the fun of that game. And people wanted something like that in Rezogun. So they've added this new mode, and they've actually done a lot of kind of subtle things to make it a little more interesting and to make it fit that rhythm of play, which is very different than how you might normally play Rezogun. So it's no longer, I mean, it is very combo based, but losing your combo isn't as dire as it may be in the arcade mode, because there's all the time in the world to get it back as long as you can stay alive. So there's that aspect of it. I think also there's no limit on the combo multiplier, which there is in all the in all the other modes. So like you can get crazy scores. But it also they changed the way that you save the humans, which are kind of the bonus mechanic of the game, and now they're very optional. You can miss them and there's really no consequence. It just helps you. The more you get, the more they help you. But it's very easy to kind of get obsessed with that rather than surviving, because you've got one life. And Rezogun is a game where things can go badly in about a split second. So you kind of have to balance your attention and make sure that you're focusing on the right priorities when you play survival. And my favorite thing about it is that when you die, it leaves like a marker, like a gravestone in the level. And the next time you play, you can see that. And there's actually like percentage counting up over the gravestone that tells you how close you are to your previous high score. And when you pass it, when you pass your high score, you can go over there and the place where you died previously will release a power up as a bonus for now getting past, you know, the farthest point you'd ever gotten before. So it's always encouraging you to play again and do better and do better and do better. And of course, they've also done a nice job, I think, of highlighting the friends leaderboards. I think they've sort of rejiggered the way that that stuff is shown. And now it feels more like, especially Geometry Wars 2, where, you know, you go to a mode and it's going to show you all your friends' high scores. And it's going to make it very easy for you to kind of set your own goals and try to come up with a plan of attack to do better. So, I think that's a nice improvement, and it's definitely made me interested to go back and spend a lot of time with it this week and try to set new scores and all the levels where my old ones got wiped. And I've played survival mode quite a bit. I think it holds up really nicely. It's a very smart sort of conversion of Resogun and the scoring mechanics, and the whole feel of playing the game is, you know, it's not totally different, but they've changed just enough things that it's interesting. I've had to come up with different strategies. And I think it fits that mode and the structure of that mode very nicely. So, I mean, that's about all I can say about Resogun. They also added a mode called Demolition, which is kind of like Arkanoid and really strange, very, very difficult. I don't like it that much. I mean, it's cool. It's exciting to try it because it's so different. But I don't think it's balanced very well. I think they need to go back and maybe tweak that one a little bit. But I still love Resogun to death, and I just actually had friends over about a week ago, and kind of on a whim said, oh hey, I want to download this thing. You guys should check this out. And I played Resogun. I think they took turns too, and everybody was just mind blown by the graphics. The game looks so cool, and all the models in the game are very simple, but because everything is made of voxels, everything explodes constantly. And when you beat the level, the entire level explodes. And as I was playing it and kind of showing it to them and explaining this, I realized why that is an advantage for Resogun. I think it's because they don't really have to model explosions. You know, like in a normal game, the explosion itself is a model and it gets really bright and it, you know, a lot of times messes up the game engine because now there's all this crazy geometry on there that wasn't there before. In the case of voxels, all the structures in the game, the ships, the enemies, the level, they're all made up of these little things, and they exist as discrete voxels all the time. So my guess is, I don't know that much about programming, especially about voxels, but my guess is that it's no more intensive on the engine to break things apart and send the pieces flying off in 1,000 different directions than it is to hold them together and just move them around on the screen like normal. So I think the engine is designed so that they can make things blow up real pretty nonstop. And why wouldn't you if you could do that? You know, yeah. There's no penalty on performance at all. It's just total madness all the time. And my friends just absolutely love the way the game looked. And I do too.
Yeah. I mean, this is by Housemarque, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I pretty much love everything they do. Huge fan of Super Stardust HD.
It is by far my favorite game of theirs.
So yeah, I mean, once I get a PS4, this is the first game I'm going to get for it.
Yes, you should.
And I'm going to love it. I can guarantee you. So
it's not free anymore with PS Plus. I think it's like $15, and it is easily worth $15.
This is one of the ones I made sure I got this. I did the download on the web store, and so I have it. It's sitting in my account.
Nice. So you've got PS4 games, but you don't even have the system yet.
Yep.
That's very smart.
But hey, that's one of the great things about PS Plus. You can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're waiting for you. Then you get the system and you just download it right away.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Just a license.
Yeah. So why don't we move on to what John's been playing?
Yeah, I'm continuing the Nintendo theme. Battlefield 4 was I got it on sale for $20. I really have no investment in the series. It's for Xbox One. I really have no investment in the series. I wasn't really particularly interested or planned on picking it up. But for $20, I was like, hey, that's a pretty good game for, you know, $20. So took a flyer on it, and yeah, it's really, really good. So game looks fantastic, much better than Ghosts. You can really tell that Frostbite 3, unfortunately, of course, the Frostbite 3 engine, to go back a ways, Frostbite 3 engine was never made for Wii U, so it will never come to Wii U, unfortunately.
I think Frostbite 3 could work on Wii U. The problem is
they're
EA
not going to.
Doesn't work on Wii U.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
the main problem.
Yep.
They just don't want to put the work. I'm sure it's a lot of work to get it working on the system.
Yeah, but the whole point of having
I mean, if we can run Crytek 3 and Unreal 4, then it can run Frostbite. They just have to do some work and optimize it.
Yeah, and besides, the whole point of having a cross-platform engine is you can make it run on other platforms, right? So why couldn't they make it run on Wii U? Anyways, yeah, so it's a shame because, you know, Battlefield 4, I think I'm going to wind up liking it a lot. It has a couple of wrinkles that it throws in there. I've only played the campaign, haven't touched multiplayer yet. I did play Battlefield 3. It was free on PS3. On PS Plus, and so I downloaded it. But I played through the campaign, and I was just kind of like, actually, I didn't play through the campaign. I played just a tiny little bit of it, and I was, you know, it wasn't really anything too great. Battlefield 4, much better. The game looks fantastic. First off, much better than Ghosts. I mean, Ghosts kind of looks like, you know, it's very obvious it's an upported 360 engine. Battlefield 4, you can tell it's really been built from the ground up.
Had a lot of the trouble online that people have reported?
Well, that's the thing. Well, no, I mean, I haven't really played in multiplayer too much at all. I haven't played at all yet.
So,
but we'll see. So I don't know about that. I'm hoping that it's been about 8 months since this has been released, so maybe EA had a chance to fix some things. Maybe
I know they've made some improvements, but apparently not all the ones that they have said are kind of on the list to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's still pending DLC for this game. Like, I think they still have, they plan to have 5 DLC packs. 3 have already been released, and 2 are coming. So.
Pay $60 for DLC for a game that you bought for $20.
Yeah, it's $50 for DLC. I don't know.
Season pass, if you're going to get all of it, I guess the season pass would be the way to go. But
yeah, I mean
that doesn't seem like a good investment to me based on, you know, the multiplayer support that they've had so far.
Yeah, I'll have to see. I really don't know what I'll do there. But I mean, again, like, you know, I'm already invested in Ghosts, so this was just kind of a let's see how this plays kind of thing. But it's really cool. I mean, the wrinkles they add in there, the two main things are that, you know, of course, it's like an open sandbox world going, the whole Battlefield series going all the way back has always just been like, you know, you spawn in the world and you can hop into any plane, grab any vehicle, grab a Jeep, drive it around, hop in a jet, fly the jet around. You can do any. So that kind of, that spawns a lot of chaos, like a lot of crazy things you can do. I mean, you can get in a Jeep and drive off of a cliff and then jump out of the Jeep and, you know, shoot down a plane. You know, just all kinds of crazy stuff like that can happen, right? Because anybody can hop into any vehicle or go anywhere at any time in the level. So that's really cool. Definitely a very different gameplay feel from, you know, something that's more kind of constrained like Ghosts or any of the other COD titles. The biggest thing too is that the environments can be destroyed around you. So you'll hop behind an object, somebody will throw a grenade at you, and it will destroy the object in front of you so you can no longer use it as cover, which is huge because typically in most shooters, you know, you can pretty much hide behind objects. Nothing can be destroyed around you, so you can hide behind objects forever. So you kind of, you know, you can just take your time and pick off enemies one by one, but you can't do that here because things will fall apart right in front of you and all of a sudden you're in a wide open area getting shot at. So you really have to, it adds kind of an urgency to the gameplay that you have to take out enemies quickly. So that's really cool.
It's funny to hear you talk about these, you know, specific features that Battlefield has, because I had forgotten that those were, like, its claim to fame. They've been so busy trying to go after the Call of Duty crowd.
Yeah.
I feel like they kind of forgot, like, to market these features.
I mean, to me, that's not really what Battlefield is. To me, Battlefield is 32x32 multiplayer capture the flag. Is that what this series still is? It seems like
it still is.
Because like they basically said, no, it's not what this is anymore.
I think they kind of look at themselves as heirs to the shooter crown or something like that. As far as I know, that's pretty much what it is. I mean, I did play some of this at the Xbox One summer event that came out before the console launched. And that was a more conventional, it wasn't some huge, like large scale thing. That was more of like kind of like an 8-on-8 sort of deathmatchy kind of thing. So
kind of like Splatoon.
Just like
I mean, to the idea of deathmatch in Battlefield, I find sort of rancid.
Heretical.
I mean, it's like that's not what that series is.
Yeah, I think they've kind of tried probably to expand it. And the thing is, that's the thing. I haven't dug into the online yet, sure. So I can't confirm it. But I think they've kind of tried to expand it to sort of bring in the more, you know, COD crowd, like more deathmatch kind of thing, and also, but then also probably cater to the larger scale battles as well. So,
you know, it's easy to imagine that this series will never come to a Nintendo platform. I don't think one has ever appeared before on Nintendo.
Well,
I mean, they weren't on consoles at all until fairly recently.
Yeah. Well, if I recall, we did have it was Battlefield, right? That, oh. Shoot, who was it? I'm blanking on who we had on the telephone that mentioned it.
Oh, yeah, Jeff Callis was saying they wanted to put it on GameCube, and Nintendo said, nah.
Nah, whatever. Get that out of here.
That was weird. That was really weird.
Yeah.
But you know what I could see, especially if EA gets it in their head eventually, that they kind of want to mend fences with Nintendo. There was that game, I don't know if any of us ever played it, but EA was doing this very early free-to-play experiment called Battlefield Heroes that was the more cartoony version. Mm-hmm. And it was free to play on PC, and they, you know, had microtransactions for cosmetic stuff.
I believe it played in your browser, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, you could play it in your browser. It'd be really interesting to see if they brought that back and put it on a system like Wii U and still made it free to play. Like, you know, tried to rack up the dollars in eShop credit.
I actually played that, but it was not a good experience.
It wasn't very fun.
It's one of the things that makes me very wary of free-to-play, you know, like, because you could buy basically, like, bandages and things like that. Like, okay, buy healing items and...
So I'm going to borrow a phrase from John here. That it didn't toe the line between pay-to-win and pay-to-compete well.
Yeah,
It leaned closer to pay-to-compete.
It was kind of an early example, so... You know, if they brought it back,
EA has been
so
much better at free to play lately, as we've seen.
I'm sure they would take another look at that stuff.
That version of the game did not have like the destructible environments and it was much smaller scale.
The old Battlefield games didn't have. That's a fairly recent addition. The only series I equate destructible environment to is Red Faction at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there are others nowadays.
Yeah, but that's the series that was known for blowing the shit out of the world that you're playing in. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. What's cool is that here it actually does affect gameplay, like, constantly. So
right.
It's not just, like, something that happens and it's like, oh, that looks neat. This is actually like, holy shit, I no longer have any cover. And you really have to watch for people, you know, what people are shooting at you, because that also determines, you know, actually not only what guns people use, but also what you're hiding behind. If it's something that's, you know, that will probably be easy to destroy, then you know you only have a limited time to stay behind it, so
right.
Yeah, but it's cool. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to check out online and see what that's like, but I think I'll have a good time with it. I don't know how much time I'll put into it overall. Mm-hmm. Who knows, I may go hog wild on it and completely ditch COD, but who knows.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it always felt like there was such a layer to what those battles felt like. I'll be really interested to hearing the online, because there is always that kind of like everything that happened in the air just fuck all to everything on the ground. I mean, basically, they had nothing to do with one another.
Yeah, I mean, the last Battlefield game I put any time into, I think, was Battlefield 1943. And that, if I remember correctly, that was kind of cartoony, was it not?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. So that's why it's like, you're totally right when it's like they took it in this direction, like, this is a realistic, gritty first-person shooter
now. Well, like, the last one that I played was 2142, which was goofy and ridiculous in all its own ways.
Yeah.
Like, there's big, dumb mechs and... And even then,
that sounds cool to me.
You still had the Battlefield 2 problem of the jets are fighting the jets, and they're not doing anything to anybody on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's just, there was always this kind of weird asymmetric warfare going on with people in tanks. Because a dude would hop in a tank and drive, or would like hop in a 5-person Jeep and drive off on his own.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, the game, it's kind of like built for assholes to be assholes, but at the same time, I kind of love it.
Yeah, it's...
That's kind of why I never connected with games like Call of Duty Online, because they're not built for that kind of really bizarre, kinetic, do whatever the shit you want kind of play.
The level of interaction in a game like Call of Duty is pretty narrow, you know?
Right.
There's a high skill ceiling, but the variety of what you might see happen in a Call of Duty match is pretty limited. You know, one match looks a lot like the next.
And that's
match.
Exactly why it's good for esports, right? It's because
right.
There's a narrow variety of skills,
competitive.
And you can hone them.
I will say my favorite Battlefield moment is probably from 2142, where somebody shot a tank in the air and just conveniently hit an airplane going overhead and it crashed.
Yeah, see, that's awesome.
I was
awesome.
Like, yes!
Yes.
This is so stupid.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Dumb stuff.
Speaking
dumb
of,
stuff.
I love it.
Speaking of things that are so stupid, James, why don't you wrap up new business with one more little
Yeah,
trinket.
Real dumb. So I went and so I was putting in a bunch of codes for Nintendo Rewards season, Club Nintendo, and it's the 31st of June, or 30th of June is the end of the year. There weren't a lot of options this month of things I really wanted. In fact, there were none. So what I ended up getting with 140 of my 240 coins, I was like, well, at least I'll spend half of them, or over half of them, was Electroplankton Rec-Rec for DSiWare, which I didn't realize they had chopped up Electroplankton and put it on DSiWare.
Oh, yeah.
I could see putting the whole game on the whole utility on DSiWare, but chopping it up is kind of a dick move.
Yeah, there wasn't that much to it to begin with. So, yeah, I agree with you. Like, chopping up into these little individual pieces is a bit of a stretch.
So I was like, yeah, Nintendo, I think the whole world wants to play Rec-Rec. So I downloaded
Rec-Rec is R-E-C-R-E-C. And I'm assuming that ties into what this thing is.
Fuck if I know. So in this one, there's four fish, neon fish, that swim through on lines. They just keep swimming. And they hit the edge of the screen, they jump back, and they swim. And they just keep doing that. And what you do is you tap on one of them. And then the next time it comes through the screen, it'll be blinking, that one fish. And you then record stuff with the DSi microphone, or in this case, the 3DS microphone, which might actually be worse than its DSi counterpart. And then every time it loops through from that point forward, it'll play back the noise that it recorded. It kind of distorts it a little bit. I think it may be slightly deterministic based on what fish you have. Let me rephrase it. It definitely distorts it a bit because the microphones are garbage. But it might additionally distort it a bit digitally. And you can set up all four fish to make different sounds. There's this weird, like, beat pattern behind it, like, boom, 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 boom. Just kind of strobing behind it. And you can adjust the speed the fish swim at with the D-pad. So you push it to the, you push it towards the left and they go faster. You push it towards the right, they slow down. So basically that's all it is. That's the whole game. That is the entire experience of Rec-Rec. You can't save your product. You can't export it in any way. That is it.
Well,
you can save
it if you're clever.
Well, you can't save it in the confines of the game.
No.
So what you can do is you could hook up a cable to the headphone jack of your 3DS/DSiWare and run it to a microphone in and record that and record the fine sounds of your music that you have created. I have one of those cables, but said, fuck it, I'm too lazy for that. Instead, I went and I took my 3DS after I made an awesome creation using audio excerpts from last week's Radio Free Nintendo. And so recorded it coming out of my PC using the 3DS microphone. I didn't even bother to take it out of my charging cradle. I'm like, fuck it, I'll just leave it in there, whatever.
Disgusting.
And then proceeded to put sound of each of you into the four slots and then played with the speed as I then turned up the 3DS speakers and recorded it directly into the laptop mic on my laptop. Because I'm doing this all about professional.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I have made the greatest piece of music that's ever been
Rube
created.
Rube Goldberg, are we even recognizable in those recordings?
Well, or? I don't know. So I have made this publicly available. I've released it to my fans.
This is a world premiere, world premiere, world premiere.
My release party will be at the Broadbury. It'll be at 11 to whenever they kick us out. The best part about it is you can really only record about 5 seconds audio, so it's completely fucking useless.
You're telling me Electroplankton isn't an actual audio production tool?
No, I mean, it's less useful than I expected it to be, and I had expected it to be completely useless. It somehow its utility managed to breach zero. Like, at some point I said, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. I am trying to find the exact moment where Johnny makes a comment about four guys not being qualified to answer a question about diversity. And trying to get that exact phrase lined up with this fish so I can get that as my beat. It's remarkable. Electroplankton is remarkable in that I am currently remarking about it right now.
Mm-hmm.
It is remarkable in all the worst ways. And I
mean, how crazy is that we're talking about Electroplankton in 2014?
Crazy is it that they said, yeah, this is the game people want to get with their coins?
That game came out, I think, like 8 years ago.
Fuck for DS. Oh, yeah, it was real early.
Yeah.
And you had to, like, special order it,
too,
in the
US. I remember the DJ session at E3.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
I gotta say, if I ever went into a club, that would be a miracle. But if I ever did, and I saw a DJ like using Electroplankton to make house music, I would get as close as possible and just camp out and watch it and be amazed.
I basically equated myself to that guy, that professional photographer who takes his pictures using a Nintendo camera or a Game Boy camera. I basically
the Game Boy camera. Yeah, that's like a weird project.
Except I am a much better artist than he is.
That's a good note. That's a good note to end new business. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail, and it's not about E3. Welcome back, everyone. It is time for listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And James has the first email this week.
Shad writes, "So I've been playing Transformers Rise of the Darkspark. While the general consensus online is that this game is pretty bad, I'm thoroughly enjoying the game, and I'm even on my third playthrough. I seem to have a knack for enjoying bad games. I honestly love Metroid Other M, and we know how bad that is. My ability to enjoy bad games probably stems from the fact that I care nothing about graphics or how bad the story is. Look at you, Other M. If the game is fun to play, I love it. All I want when I sit down to play a game is to have fun. This may be a bad question to ask people who professionally critique games, but have any of you guys ever enjoyed playing a game that was generally considered to be bad?
Mylon's Secret Castle.
Yeah, I mean, that game is shit garbage.
There are a lot of people who hate Mylon's Secret Castle, and some of them have played it because I compelled them to play it, but I have no regrets.
I will give you his address.
Very honestly.
Yeah.
I have strong reasons for enjoying that game. Part of it is circumstance, and part of it is that I can appreciate parts of it that other people either don't care to really focus on, or they just have never seen those parts of the game because they can't get there, or maybe they just don't appreciate it. You know, maybe they don't see that stuff as good.
Maybe they don't tolerate it, you mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was thinking about this with my old ass. And I was thinking that probably
with your old ass.
When you're a kid, sometimes I miss being able to just play games without really critiquing them. Because when you're a kid, you don't really critique games very much. It's like you can just play the crappiest games.
Yeah,
and you just enjoy
them. A game's got to be real horseshit for you as a kid to go, oh, yeah, God, this is
like
bad.
It has to pretty much be non.
It's got to be Fester's Quest. I mean, really.
Yeah.
Fester's Quest.
Don't that game.
I do.
That is the only game I've ever played where no matter how fast you shoot, you can't kill the enemies faster than they spawn.
Oh, that's great. I've got dozens upon dozens of WiiWare games. I'm sure I like some games that people say are bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Enjoy Your Massage. I mean, absolutely, right? That's a good game.
Enjoy Your Massage isn't a bad game. It's not a game. It's performance.
It's an experience.
Metroid Other M, I actually enjoy, and I'm not sure, like, does that really qualify as a bad game?
Because
the reviews were mixed. You know, some people hated it, but a lot of people
I like Other M.
Yeah.
Like, I have serious issues with it, but I enjoyed playing it. I think a lot of it is really fun. And I've actually been thinking very seriously about going back and playing through it again, maybe live streaming it one weekend coming up pretty soon. So, yeah, I don't. You know, it's one of my least favorite Metroid games, but that doesn't make it a bad game. It's still very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think most people feel that that Other M is good. You know, not maybe not great, not amazing, but good.
Yeah,
not bad.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a difference between unenjoyable and lacking enjoyment. And, yeah, and that's, yeah, like, that's that can be kind of sound like you're saying the same thing, but you're not.
Say yeah, a game like Transformers, which I have not played at all, and I've played Transformers games. I've reviewed them in the past. I actually have very vivid memories of reviewing. I think it was the first Transformers movie game.
Yeah, it would have been.
And I was reviewing. Yeah, because this would have been.
Because you weren't reviewing when Dark of the Moon came out.
Right, right.
Because I think Zach reviewed that game and just wanted to kill himself.
But I even went on a press junket and out in San Francisco and saw. Or no, maybe actually that was in Santa Monica when I saw the Transformers game from Activision. But I reviewed it. I think it was the same one. Maybe it was the next one. But I remember reviewing a game at the beach on a family vacation, and I took my Wii with me, and which the family was okay with because they wanted to play tennis or whatever. But I was like, yeah, but when you guys are done with that, I need to get on this Transformers thing and play this because I got to write a review for it. And I remember that game being okay. You know, like it didn't stand out. I think a lot of these licensed games have this issue where they tried
hard enough to not piss off the license holder.
Well, it's more that they're doing the best they can with limited resources and especially limited time. And yeah. And yes, they're working with a publisher and a license holder who don't care that much about the quality. What they care about is getting it out on the date that it needs to get out.
Get that Skrilla.
And yeah, and they typically are like, we want this type of game. Don't deviate from this plan. We want this. We don't want you to be creative. Want,
you know,
just get it out
I
there.
I don't even think they care that much about what kind of game it is. And I think a lot of developers have tried to get clever with you know, with basing their licensed games on sort of popular, well-known genres that people are familiar with, and in particular, there have been a few Transformers games that actually got pretty good reviews. I think it was High Moon Studios made a couple of them that were not linked directly to the movies.
No, and those were Hasbro making their own thing.
Yeah, and they were 3D shooters. They were third-person shooters. Like, they weren't anything super special, but they were competently made, and they were fun to play, and people really liked them, you know? And
yeah. Like, I don't think
maybe the new movie game is like that too. I think from reviewers, yes, a lot of times these games are going to get lower reviews because they are kind of generic. You know, like really the license is the only thing that sets them apart from any other game. And if you don't really care that much about the license in the first place, then that's not even a benefit. So it ends up just feeling like other things, but maybe not as good. So you can see how they might not get great scores.
And if you play a bunch of games as part of your job, you're going to play a lot of examples of games that may be better than this, and that it's going to seem egregiously worse than it probably is.
I mean, I think if you really want the crappy games now, they're probably on PC.
No, they're on phones.
Well,
PCs
and phones because and my thought process there is that because making console games is so much more costly than it used to be.
Oh, yeah.
I think that probably console games, you don't really find too many horrible, horrible games because the upfront investment, there's no way somebody's going to make a shitty game.
There's some real garbage on eShop. Mm-hmm. There is some human refuse on Steam. But when you move into the mobile space is where shit just gets unbearable.
Flappy Bird. I mean,
Flappy
that's
Bird
a piece of shit.
Is,
come on. I mean,
Flappy Bird is great compared to some of the shit that's out there on phones. I mean, there are games on phones that literally just crash your phone.
Made by people that are rank amateurs. Like, they do not know what they're doing, but
the
they just wanted to put a game
up there. The barrier for entry is so low that it almost makes a lot of sound. Like,
it's just a completely free market. I mean, there are no rules. Anybody can make whatever they want, even if they have no idea what they're doing. And the market is large enough that there's probably somebody who will be dumb enough to download that.
Yeah.
They may not pay for it, but they'll download it at least.
I think that the whole idea of a bad game, like, I don't know, if we're basing that on critical reception, on reviews, I think that reviews, when it comes to AAA games, they mostly reflect, you know, a certain set of values that I perhaps don't always agree with. Like, the reviews will respect, I don't know, impressive graphics, whether it's, you know, like the scope of a game like GTA or, you know, the very detailed but more closed areas of something like Uncharted. And they'll, I don't know, they'll put a lot of value on good gameplay, quote unquote. And that usually means like controls that you're already kind of familiar with if you play a lot of video games. You know, like a game might pan the grenade throwing in a game because, well, it's not like Halo did it, and every other game follows Halo, so you know, like this is not what I'm used to, and it's kind of jarring.
Or their review is kind of a veiled review of Nintendo the company and not whatever game they put out.
Right. Well,
yeah. Yeah.
There's values. Sure.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sure. You do have the shit that I'll mock on Twitter every so often that does stuff like that. But really, to get to the question of, you know, what defines a bad game. I mean, there are games where if you look at the critical reception and it's universally really high or universally pretty low, regardless of your personal values, yeah, there's probably something about that game. Mm-hmm. Something, either something bad or something good about it that makes it stand out.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, some of my worst gaming experiences have been like really highly rated games.
There's two points there. When you play the game, did you recognize that, yeah, it is a quality product? It's just not fun for me. Cause that's the division sometimes you have to make as a reviewer. You're like, yeah, for somebody else, this could be a really good game versus, no one will enjoy this game.
If it's not connecting with you, then it's not. And we're talking about really two different things here, guys, because whether a game is good or bad, I mean, I think that means very little. You know, I think that's – it's a good shorthand, but it's really not that useful in terms of actual critique. And generally when we're writing reviews or when we're talking about a game here on the show, what we focus on rightly, I think, is did this game work for me? And why or why not? And that's more relatable. And, you know, trying to say that a game is good or amazing or terrible is a little bit of a, you know, it's kind of a fallacy. I mean, it really doesn't mean that much whether one person says, I think this game is the best game ever made. I don't know how useful that is to anybody really. And this idea of consensus is, you know, very troubling as well.
The consensus kind of exists though. Like you go to sites like Metacritic and you can see that a lot of scores are the same for some games.
Consensus is in the eye of the beholder. It's also very easy to manipulate critique in order to show consensus where it may not actually exist. I mean, if 50 reviews of one game are on Metacritic and they all roughly fall into very similar scores, but they all talk about completely different things about the game, is that a consensus? I would say no.
Is that likely to happen though? I don't think it is.
Well, Metacritic makes it happen because number one, they do all kinds of crazy shit on people's scores to convert them into whatever they think they're worth. And then they do a bunch of statistics on it. So most people don't even look at the individual scores very much, or they only look at the outliers. And the other thing is because sites like Metacritic exist, and they have every right to exist, and people have the right to go look at that stuff, although I don't think it's very useful, frankly. But because that site exists and because reviewers know that it exists, it tends to drive scores together or away from each other. If you're the kind of person who asks yourself, I wonder how my score is going to compared to other people's scores, then you're probably the kind of person who is willing or is at least open to eventually adjusting scores to make them more similar to other people's scores or farther away from other people's scores in order to get attention. I think that's actually more likely. Like the idea of bandwagoning it by reviewers is fairly preposterous in my experience as a reviewer. Usually I don't even think of reading anyone else's review until mine is finished because I don't want to accidentally plagiarize their thoughts. I want it to be my review. So I don't even talk to other people about the game. I don't go read anything about it until my review is done. Now, as an editor, you might want to keep an eye on what other people are doing. Mainly, in my experience as an editor, I mainly would do that to make sure that our person reviewing it didn't completely miss something that is in the game.
That never happens.
That other people talked about.
So exactly. That never happens. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about.
It happens a lot. And so I use other reviews as a way to fact check our own reviewer, but what I'm not doing is being like, hey, your score is way lower. Maybe we should bump it up so that it doesn't look quite so crazy. I would never say that to
a reviewer. Well, the only thing I would say in that vein would be, hey, maybe based on the way you've criticized the game in your review, your score seems a little bit high. The tone of your review doesn't really indicate that we would give it this high a score. There's a disconnect.
If you're going to do scores, you should compare the score to the text of the review. Should align to some way. It should feel like they're consistent.
As an editor, though, if what I read sounds like it's a completely different game than everything else I read, I'm going to go like, dude, this is kind of nuts.
Yeah, I'm gonna have further inquiries as to like what was going on with this, or like, did you try this?
Is
other
your Wii
mode?
U fucking up, bro? What's up?
Getting away from how we write reviews, that's not really the question. I think that there's a certain set of values that a lot of people agree make a good video game. You know, like it has to have controls that you don't fight against or that feel comfortable and things like that. It has to. The visuals have to wow you, whether by their artistry or, technically or whatever.
Yeah,
like,
they have to
there
be
are
effective.
Some games. Yeah, and there are they some games work. That people just kind of rally behind and agree, like, this is a good game. Mm-hmm. And I find myself usually turned off by things in those games that don't seem to turn off other people. Or I actually.
I think, again, you could still look at the objectively and say, this game is well executed at what it's attempting to do or not. It's not for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I fucking don't want to play Monster Hunter games.
No, but even then, I think that there's, I don't know, like, I think that those quote-unquote objective values are actually kind of reflect, like, an importance that we give to, like, the budget behind a game.
Yeah, but the thing is, those objective values could also be applied to games that you like, though, Guillaume.
No,
like, those
sure.
same arguments, right? So...
Right. I mean, you know, like are these controls stupid? I think everybody can agree, like, yeah, if the controls don't make any sense.
I'm not saying here, like, I'm the only one who has impeccable taste and everyone is wrong, but I'm just saying that there is a specific kind of game or a specific kind of budget sometimes and a specific kind of, I don't know, like, yeah, certain types of games that seem to draw to them like critical acclaim and like positive opinions, and
they're called Zelda and Mario and
sure,
you know what I'm saying? Like, you can make that argument both ways. That's all I'm saying.
Sure. Okay, so I think we're in agreement. But anyway, I guess what I want to say is that maybe you shouldn't care too much about what quote unquote good games are, and just go for what's interesting. I think that a better measurement of whether or not a game is worth my money is if I find not the premise interesting, but just the way it's put together. Or, you know, like, there might be something about the art style that, even though it's not super lavish or things like that, there's just something unique about it. And I don't know, that's how I ended up with like 20 or so WiiWare games. Like, there was something unique about them, something interesting
They're appealing to you.
Yeah, sure.
I think there are games that we can pretty categorically say, that game's not very good. I think, Johnny's phrase, the use of industry best practices. If there is a game that consistently deviates or fails to execute on things that are pretty fundamental, then regardless of what else the game is doing, it's got serious issues.
Well, yeah. I'm going to throw out the example that I have in my head, like Tomb Raider, the recent remake, is kind of a, you know, like, kind of a collection of best practices of in modern gaming.
And I love that.
No, but it is. Like,
I can just see that, like, in the pitch for the game. All right, guys.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, we got the best industry best practices, like first person shooter / adventure / platformer we could possibly get. All
right,
go,
right,
do it.
No, but anyway, so, like, I think that the game does a lot of things right, and you can tell that the people who made it play a lot of good games, and went and picked and chose stuff that they liked and that they knew worked, and they implemented it in their own game.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, when I played it, the way it was integrated together, it really rubbed me the wrong way, you know? And I felt like, okay, sure, I can tell that these guys know what they're doing, but I think that they did it for the wrong reason, or, you know, like, it's not really working out for me. You know,
right,
like, sure, like, Lara can just auto-regenerate because that's what games do now and that's what people like now.
So,
but it's completely at odds with a story that is also good and is also something that people want to see, like a kind of vulnerable character who's growing. But yes, when that, you combine that game both is together, chock
full of cognitive dissonance. But sure. Whether that makes it a good game or a bad game completely depends on your own individual reaction to it. My point that I've been trying to get to for the past 10 minutes or so is that as a reviewer, I get really frustrated when I, and not that I'm a reviewer anymore, but when I talk about a game even, and I have a lot of praise for it, and I have a couple of criticisms, and I can comment that it's maybe not the most original thing, but I really enjoyed it, and there's a lot of fun stuff in there, and then someone comes away with that and says, oh, he gave it a bad review. And I think that's a lot of what – I think that really gets to the heart of the matter here with Shad's question, because these games like Transformers that are kind of generally considered to be bad games, which I think is his language, that doesn't mean a whole lot to me because, for one thing, our expectations of video games are so skewed and they're so strange that, yes, a lot of people have trouble enjoying a game that may be – very solid and full of entertaining moments and could be something that a lot of, you could put it in front of a lot of people and they would have a good time with it. But if you're in the bubble and you're so wrapped up in, you know, the latest, most innovative games, then that can be hard to appreciate how other people might see that. And to go ahead and call that a bad game is, I think, a little bit irresponsible. But also, I don't necessarily lay that at the blame of the reviewers, because I think a lot of times, and we've all experienced this, Neil just had Neil and Don both went through a whole lot of shit with their Mario Kart reviews where they gave it 7.5s and then got – Neil literally got death threats for giving Mario Kart 8 a 7.5.
That's absolutely
ridiculous. What the fuck are you doing with your life that you're going to write a death threat to somebody because they gave a game – a very good score according to our own metrics, you know, and that is crazy to me. And the idea that Neil hates Mario Kart because he gave it that score, you know, is just preposterous. So that really bothers me. And I think people really need to reevaluate what it means to for a game to be good or bad. Just because you don't want to play a game, I mean, I don't want to play fucking Transformers, but just because I don't want to play it doesn't mean I think it's a bad game. It's just a game that doesn't appeal to me.
Yep.
And that's – there's the selection has never been broader for what people can do in video games. There is a game for every person on the planet right now. For a lot of us, there's way too many that we're interested in. And I don't have time to get all stressed out or get too haughty-taughty on games that I have absolutely no intention of ever playing. And that's fine. There's too many games for any one person to play. You got to be picky. You got to be choosy. That doesn't mean you have to put down all the ones that didn't make the cut for you.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever – just advice for anybody out there. If you ever find yourself getting angry at a score that is given to a game on a review site, just close your laptop and just walk away from the internet for like a year or two.
Even if you have a desktop, close your laptop.
Yes, close your laptop.
And if the game isn't out yet, just close your laptop until it's actually released.
Why do you care what score anybody gives a game that you're interested in?
Exactly.
It's just more of this internet madness.
Here's another important piece of advice to go out on. You should never criticize something that you have no experience with whatsoever. If you haven't played a game, shut the fuck up about it. Don't criticize something that you have not even tried. You know, I'm not going to go tell you that, you know, that such and such MMO is a bad game. I've never touched it. Okay. I admit my own ignorance. I live with it. I'm not going to change it. But I'm also not going to go around and tell people, oh, that sucks. You don't need to play that. That thing blows.
At the same time, if you're interested in it, you may try one at one point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I plan to. Sorry, I just picked an example.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, like, you know, you're open to it. So who cares, right?
Yes. Yes. So let's move on and go on to the next email. I believe Guillaume has the next email.
Kuko writes, first off, great show. I look forward to it every week. I do miss Greg, so give him a shout out for me. Hey, Greg. Well, I'm a big Nintendo fan. My number one console right now is my Zelda 3DS XL. It's actually my third XL. I recently acquired a used, beat-up Wii U console with no power brick for about $100 from Craigslist. I cleaned it up, and aside from some minor scratches on the console, it actually looks pretty new, like it was never used. The gamepad was just really dirty and dusty, but after I cleaned it, it looks practically new. I brought it home and very excitedly showed my wife the gamepad, which she looked at like, what the fuck is this? Now, my wife is not big into games. She does, however, own a Ping 3DS, where she plays Animal Crossing and also enjoys doing the Leyden puzzles. So my question is, what is a good game that shows off what the gamepad can do? Something that is easy to get into with simple controls. I was thinking something like Nintendo Land or Game & Wario. I don't have any Wiimotes. Are most games playable with just a gamepad, or am I now obligated to go out and buy some Wii remotes?
So if you've got ideas for a gamepad demonstrating game, please contact Nintendo. Because they are looking for ideas and are now soliciting them. Thank you.
Yeah, other than off-TV play, it's pretty slim pickings. And unfortunately, some of the games that do show off the gamepad in really interesting ways, like Nintendo Land and Wii Party U, do require a Wii remote for every player, pretty much. And so if you don't want to go buy a bunch of controllers, which I don't blame you, I think one of your best choices is probably Bumpy's Party. Spin the bottle.
Zombie U, maybe?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be real approachable for somebody who doesn't really get into games.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Bumpy's Party is like, you need basically at least three people, I think, to have any kind of fun. Like, just two people, it's not really much
of a
party.
Two people will get a divorce, basically, is what he's saying.
Yeah, no, you're right. Three or four people is best, but you don't need a bunch of extra controllers. You just use the gamepad. And that's why I really like it. I mean, if you can invite people over, if you've got kids, if you've got a significant other who can be around and you can just pull in one other person. That game is really fun, and I recently played Wii Party U with some friends, but we can only do a two-player because I only have two Wii remotes. I mean, I have a pro controller, I have a classic controller, I have nunchucks, I have a whole bunch of different
controllers. A whole lot of plastic crap.
Yeah.
Yep. I have a whole bunch of stuff for the system, but I could only play two players on that game. And I thought that was, I mean, especially coming off Mario Kart 8, that we thought that was ridiculous. Because in 8, you can use everything. You know, right. It's like Smash Brothers. You can use whatever controller you want.
Yeah,
that's the way it should be.
That's the worst news that we have to give to Coco here. Like, if you never owned a Wii, if you only own a Wii U now, you have to buy a whole mess of controllers. And it's not so bad when you've been buying them for the last 10 years, but at this point, you have a lot of catching up to do. One of the tips I would have to give is that some games actually include Wii remotes, so you might want to wait for a sale on one of those. And in some cases, those games will go on sale for lower than the price of a Wii remote. So you actually get a brand new controller and kind of a free game for it.
Yeah, but that game may be Fling Smash, and I'd rather pay the full price for a controller than own
well,
a copy
of Fling
Smash.
You could get Wii Party U that way. And was there one for Mario, maybe? There might have been a Wii remote bundle for
there
Mario.
There was Skyward Sword had a Wii remote bundle.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and that was Wii Remote Plus.
Yep.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too bad, actually.
No, so, but I think that was limited edition.
There are a glut of used Wii Remote Pluses out on the market that are fairly cheap. My statement would be make sure you get a Plus and don't get a traditional Wii Remote, or you will not be able to use it for some things.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. But yeah, I wish there was more stuff that you could do without having to have a bunch of extra controllers, but I think maybe some of the stuff on Game & Wario, that's mostly a single-player game, I think, though. I don't think it has a ton of multiplayer. There's a couple modes, but a lot of it is single-player. That may be okay. I mean, Game & Wario is not the greatest product overall, you know, from what I've heard. I have not played much of
it
myself.
It does have a neat little drawing thing you can do where people give words and then you draw a picture. It uses the Miiverse, and that's fun. I mean, it's goofy and stupid, but it's kind of fun.
A game like that, you might have fun just even though maybe only one person's using the controller, but maybe other people could be in the room and enjoy it. You could take turns. You could pass it around. I think Scribblenauts might be a good choice
that
as well.
Oh, yeah. Actually, Scribblenauts, you do have to buy another Wii Remote, but it does have multiplayer if you have extra Wii Remotes around on the Wii U version. And
I think it's also just a good, like, pass-around, if you play it as single player, it's a game you can enjoy as a group, you know?
Yeah.
You can take turns, and you can all
But
laugh
I will
it.
Say, it is kind of a dumb, but really kind of stupid fun multiplayer game. Because you get to control the items directly. And it makes for all kinds of real stupid shit of people getting in the way of the person trying to solve the level.
Yeah.
I think I would browse the eShop and look at some of the indie games. I think you're likely to find some good uses of the gamepad there. For instance, the Two Tribes games, the developers of Tokitori and Edge, They make some good use of the touchscreen. Tokitori can be played entirely with a stylus, and it's actually not a bad option.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, the first one, the one that they're selling for like $2, all their games are $2 except for Tokitori 2, which is also pretty cheap. I think it's a very good value for the price.
Yeah, I mean, none of those are really multiplayer games, but...
But I mean, like, if his wife like enjoys Leyden puzzles, she might also enjoy platformers and things like that. So I think that those are good showcases.
Yeah, I didn't see you coming from that angle, but that makes sense. I mean, for that matter, Pushmo World is a good choice that just about anybody can enjoy, even, you know, kids, anybody can enjoy it. I had somebody over last weekend who's just visiting, very briefly stopped in and said, "Hey, do you have a game we could play for just a few minutes?" And I was like, "Yeah, let's try Pushmo." And she does not play games. I mean, it had been a long time since I think she'd played any kind of game. She was asking if I had Tetris. I was like, "Well, I'd have to go in the Wii shop and download it, and it would be really annoying." So I didn't. But she played Pushmo for a good 20, 30 minutes and like really, really enjoyed it. You know, just went through the tutorials, which anybody would have to do the first time. But yeah, that was a pretty easy pick up and play. It kind of impressed me that the game held up pretty well under those circumstances. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely plenty of good games that you can play with just the gamepad, but they're not necessarily multiplayer. So maybe keep that in mind.
And they don't necessarily show off the gamepad particularly well either.
Nintendo Land has some fun things you can do without any Wii remotes, but if you want to play multiplayer, you got to have them.
Yeah.
Definitely. Wii Fit U is another game that I think Wii Fit U is great, but you need a ton of controllers to do most of that stuff.
Yeah, including a balance board, which is, maybe a used one would be also cheap.
Yeah, I got a used balance board for like $15, I think.
That's not too bad.
I mean, you just bleach the hell out of it and you're fine. Yeah. Okay, so John has the next email.
All right.
No, I do. Wait, sorry, this is... Forgot the order.
I think it would
be. Sorry, John.
Yep.
So the next email comes from Klex Yoshi, and he writes, "Nintendo's most anticipated game of 2014 is going to be primarily played with controllers that have been on the market since 2001. One of the major critiques being leveraged against the portable version of this game from E3 Impressions is that there isn't some sort of IR adapter, so you can lug a GameCube controller with you, or some horrible Frankenstein awfulness that is some amalgamation of the GameCube keyboard controller and the CirclePad Pro to shell your 3DS/XL into make it more GameCube-like. These people probably also wish that their 3DS XL had a giant lunchbox handle on it, but I digress. At some point, Nintendo is going to have to cut the umbilical cord and stop supporting these damn things. I know one could argue that in much the same way that an arcade joystick and nice and clicky and slammy buttons, or that racers need a wheel and pedals, that the GameCube controller is the Smash Brothers controller, although I've very clearly seen people wanting the things for playing other games as well. What does Nintendo have to do to at least get this boisterous clamoring for GameCube controllers down to a dull roar? If they finally get back to a standardized sort of controller for their next hardware, what things do they keep from the GCN controller, and what do they jettison out into the cosmos?"
I mean, here's the thing, and there's real potential here for us to go on another tangent that's going to get emails from people, but there is a community that wants every Smash Brothers experience to be Melee. In every conceivable way, they want it to be Melee, and that includes the controller. You will never shut those people up.
There are some people who are just still playing Melee very regularly. So in Melee, you have to play with the GameCube controller. It doesn't support anything else.
Right.
And if you never migrated over to Brawl, which all of course also supported those, but it had a lot of other options as well. But if you never migrated to Brawl, then you've never played Smash Brothers with anything other than a GameCube controller.
You may have played with an N64 controller.
Maybe not. A lot of people never played the first one very much.
Now, Melee is the choice among competitive Smash players, right?
It's typically the choice among people who love Smash Brothers because it's better. It's better than Brawl. I think Brawl is great, but Melee is better than Brawl.
I actually disagree with that statement, fundamentally. Mm. I think Brawl is a more fun game. I think Brawl is more chaotic. I think Brawl is just more fun for me to play. I've had much more fun experiences with Brawl than I did with Melee.
Interesting.
I feel like the shit that happens in Brawl is way dumber, and I love that. But that's to me and to Sakurai, that's what this series is about. Dumb shit happening.
But it happens all the time in Brawl.
To
this male's point, though, I think the only way that Nintendo gets away from that is by making a game that is as accepted, quote-unquote, as Melee, but doesn't use the GameCube controllers. And this,
yeah, but the people who are real anal retentive about this don't want something that is accepted as Melee. They want Melee.
Well,
no, let's get away from that, James, yeah. Because the,
well, no,
the point
that's,
is,
that is the problem.
But shut up for a sec. The point is that this isn't Melee. This is a new game. It is not going to be Melee. It may be similar in some ways. It may be better in some ways. Or maybe the community decides they don't like this one either, and they just keep playing Melee. But the point being, this is a new game, and it's a little strange to want to play it with a controller for a system that came out almost 15 years ago.
Yeah. Now, maybe this new game will be better on controllers other than the GameCube controller. That's the only way I could see that happening. You know what I mean?
Like, that would be interesting.
The community would. It's going to be the community that decides this ultimately.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Nintendo could have decided it by just not releasing this dumb dongle.
Absolutely true.
Yes. Look, they are catering, you could argue pandering, to a certain subset of people who want to play with GameCube controller and they don't want to learn anything else. But I'll also say Nintendo has dug this hole for themselves because there really isn't a standard controller for Wii U. And I think it's a big problem for the platform that we just got done talking about in the previous email. I mean, you have the system comes with a gamepad. You cannot go buy other gamepads. That is the one. That's a unique controller for your system. And then outside of that, where do you go next? Wii remotes. Well, Wii remotes certainly are not good for playing Smash Brothers. I think most of us, almost everyone, would agree with that. I know a few strange people play with only the remote, but if you don't play with just the remote, then you have to play with a nunchuck, which is also very weird, and that's an old controller too, of course. Or you can plug in a classic controller, or you can play with the new Pro controller. I think a lot of the problem here is that Nintendo has made the Pro controller probably a little more expensive than a lot of people want to pay. They haven't really marketed it very much. It's hard to find in stock at most stores, in my experience. You don't really see them that often. And they haven't really told people that it's supported. They also haven't supported it very well. I mean, it took them 6 months at least to patch it into to the launch Mario title title.
Sure.
So you know, the fact that it really isn't supported by many games, at least not yet, is a big problem. And I think if they had, and some people frankly don't like the Pro controller, and that's okay too. The button layout is a little strange, mm-hmm. but I think it would behoove Nintendo on their next platform to be a little more upfront and say, look, these are the new controllers. You can buy more than one of them. This is the one that if you want to play multiplayer, this is the one you buy. And right now the situation on Wii U is just way more confusing than that. And it's led to probably the natural conclusion, which is that why don't you just let me play with the one I already know how to play with?
Yep.
Yeah, but this just makes the problem worse.
Yeah.
This introduces a whole nother set of controllers.
Well, they can't make it better.
They could not make it worse.
I mean, it doesn't hurt anything by adding another controller.
No,
I think it just
increases the confusion.
It does.
I think the decision here only made sense in the context of, hey, we're releasing GameCube games in the Virtual Console. I think in no other context releasing this thing makes any damn sense. Releasing it for one game is stupid.
Yeah, and that may still come.
Yeah, but that's not what the context they released it in.
For right now, the GameCube adapter, I think, is going to be a very limited edition item. It's probably only going to be sold from their website. I know there's a bundle with the game, but I'm not sure that's going to be sold at retail. And the controllers, I doubt, are going to be widespread at retail. I mean, what GameStop manager wants to carry GameCube controllers? They don't even sell GameCube games anymore.
No,
Why would they want to sell GameCube controllers that are only supported by literally one game in existence?
It would be bizarro land at this point.
For the part of the question when he's talking about like the next Nintendo system, if they go back to a standardized controller, it's kind of weird that he asks, what things do they keep from the GCN controller and what do they, just get rid of? Like, why why would the next standardized controller be based on the GameCube controller? I don't think it should
which
be.
Is, yeah, like, which I is mean, completely non-standard.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the only issue I have with the Wii U Pro controller is they put the face buttons in the secondary position and put the camera control stick in the primary.
Yep.
I like the way the sticks are. I just feel the buttons are too far down. They almost, like, fall off the bottom edge of the controller.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you flip them, it's more of a standard 3D controller layout.
Yep, sure. Just clone the 360 controller. Just do that.
Yeah,
Nintendo.
I mean, well, if
Thanks,
you do
guys.
That, it is it. If you do Thanks, that, boys. It is a 360 controller. It really is.
Yeah.
Well,
it's like,
or you could put in the Sony layout either too if you wanted.
No. Yeah. That's worse. That's a 2D.
Well, you see,
layout.
That's the whole thing. They did it basically so that they couldn't get sued by Sony or by Microsoft, but their controller looks almost identical to most of those.
Yeah,
well,
if you do the Sony controller, you're still making 2D games.
Mm-hmm. What I do like about the Pro controller is that the buttons are digital. I have strong feelings about digital buttons versus analog. I don't think that analog buttons feel right. And
I'll fight you.
Really? Because
yeah,
I just
analog
like
buttons are great.
No, because most of the time in most games that actually use them, I find myself having to press too hard. Like sometimes, I don't know, like in a racing game, I'll be slowing down and I'm like, what's going on? And
get better
it turns
fingers.
Out I'm just not pressing hard enough down on the button. That's
yeah,
a stupid, stupid use.
Do some workouts.
There, I don't think any of the current consoles have analog buttons.
What? I thought that they all did, except for Nintendo.
Sony dropped it for PS4. I'm almost...
Oh, wow. Okay. Johnny, I'm talking about the face buttons. Like, have they dropped face analog buttons?
Oh, analog face buttons were like a big deal for PS2, and then they were used in Metal Gear Solid 2, and then people hated it.
They
I'm
were
not
great.
Even sure they were in the PS3 controller.
Oh, yeah,
I'm
no,
almost
they
positive
were.
They're not in the PS4 controller.
I would be very surprised.
They are. You can feel the secondary push on the PS3 controller.
Hmm.
The analog shoulder buttons need to come back because
yeah, that's a good feature.
As someone who suffered through SSX3 on a GameCube controller, I'm not so sure.
No, trust me. I played Need for Speed Most Wanted U without analog. It made a huge difference. The inability to say I'm going to slow down here through this turn, but not completely let off the gas, is a real bummer.
Okay, but yeah. I say drop the click. I know it's beloved by some, but don't have the analog click.
Yeah, I don't like it either.
Why? Well, I mean, the click just tells you hit the bottom.
No, you actually had to add more pressure to make it click.
You have weak baby fingers, sir.
I do, but that's what GameCube was a system for weak babies.
Your
so
art
I don't
for
see.
This should be one of those grip exercise devices.
It's James, you're actually incorrect here. I mean, it is a slight ridge. It doesn't take much extra pressure, but it takes a little bit, and it's supposed to be an extra position, and very few games ever really did anything with it, and I completely agree that you can get rid of it.
Yeah, and in games like SSX3 and EA games, for the most part, like NBA Street and whatever, like they actually made the games painful to play over long periods of time.
Hmm. Did you have to click a lot?
Oh, well, yeah. Like, if you wanted the action to actually happen, you had to click them. It was awful.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's just bad game design, though. That's
yeah,
not bad
it
control.
Is. It's a bad use of the... I mean, those shoulder buttons are there, but you don't have to use them, or you don't have to use them for that in that way. Yeah, that stuff should go away. I don't think very much of the GameCube controller should ever come back. I don't think it's that great of a controller. It feels like the handles are nice.
Yes.
The analog stick was.
I think the layout
the left analog stick was nice, and the handles were nice. Other than that, I don't think I like anything about that controller.
Yeah. Now let me ask this, just out of curiosity. Are the handles on the GameCube controller like the handles on the PS4 controller? Because they look similar.
Yes, they're very similar.
Interesting.
Very, very similar. Yes.
Yeah, I like the layout, though. I like the primary movement control stick being where your thumb's primary rest position is, the face pad buttons being where your right thumb's rest position is, camera control being low on the right, and D-pad being low on the left.
Yeah, all that's fine. But the C-stick sucks, and the buttons themselves suck, and the shoulder triggers weren't very good, and the click barely worked. The Z-button is fucking terrible.
The start button is terrible.
The D-pad is terrible. It's not that great of a controller. That's what annoys me about
on the shoulders.
Nintendo bringing it back.
The shoulders felt great.
I agree. It's kind of a goofball controller. Fucking Z-button.
It's neat, and at the time, it was a curiosity.
It looks
sure.
neat if you
it
like purple
set the system apart.
Circus acts.
Mine was
with trampolines
black,
and mimes.
No, I liked how the controller just felt, and I including the shoulders because they were big and your fingers could rest on them naturally.
Sure,
fine, but the click part of it was just really pointless.
Yeah,
didn't care for that at all.
I didn't have any issues with it.
So which part of that controller do Smash Melee fans think make it the ultimate controller?
The fact
for
it's
that
the
game?
Controller they grew up playing with.
Yep. Exactly. Now that's totally correct, because there's really I always hear people say GameCube controller is the ultimate Smash Brothers controller. There's nothing about that controller that is like perfectly tuned to
Smash
Brothers.
Here comes the emails.
Yeah.
Here comes the emails.
I can hear them coming in right now.
We're not going to read them on the show. Don't send them.
I can hear them coming in.
It's fine, but I played a ton of Brawl with a classic controller, and it is better than a GameCube controller in every way. It's better for Smash Brothers. You don't have to deal with things like analog triggers, which have no purpose in Smash.
Last email.
Mercy, yes. Mercy. All right. Josh, his real name, writes, I listen to RFN religiously, but I tend to stretch my listening out over the course of a week. I see the podcast download every Sunday night and cannot wait until Monday evening to start listening to it. I say start because I take 5 days to listen to each RFN episode. After a long, hot day at work.
Shut up, John!
The two things I most look forward to are getting a shower and listening to the podcast. So
they
I combine
hand in hand.
So I combine the two. I turn on my Bluetooth speaker, cue up the podcast, and hop into the shower. It made my day to hear on this week's episode the hilarious bathroom mishap, and it made me want to write in to assure other listeners that enjoying RFN in the bathroom doesn't have to result in a trip to the hospital, but can be a relaxing part of your daily grooming ritual.
Great.
Thanks again for the laughs, gaming info, and sense of community I get whenever I listen to you all.
Is this how we're going to end the show now with emails about...
We have a motto, RFN, part of your daily grooming ritual.
Jesus!
I'm just glad that it is possible for listeners to touch themselves while listening to the podcast,
rubbing
so safely.
Rubbing that loofah all over their body while James talks about Ogre Battle 64. God, it just turns me on. It makes me hot.
All right, that'll do it for this week. Tune in next week when somebody tells us how they use us on the bidet.
By the way, I hate to be that guy, but we really should say, if you're going to listen to our show in the shower, please make sure your speaker is nowhere near the water and is not in danger of falling off or getting knocked into.
Well, unless
we
you
don't
have
want
one of those
any
waterproof
electrical accidents here.
And make sure you put new paper on the roll. Just save everybody a headache.
Well, he could have one of those waterproof bath shower speakers.
I suppose
isn't
that's
true.
Possible.
Yeah, isn't the whole hair dryer in the bath thing like kind of a myth? Like it can't really kill you.
It'll just cut power.
Yeah.
It would feel bad. I mean, it could maybe kill a baby, which is probably the main reason that it's on there. Yeah.
Okay. Don't kill
people put babies.
Don't kill babies.
Don't kill
that's
babies.
Never good.
Don't kill babies.
Yeah. Don't kill babies and listen to us in the shower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Josh, I hope you enjoyed us turning your email into discussion on Infant Side. So, that's going to do it for the show this week.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's roll into plugs and get out of here. This gets worse.
Take it away, James.
Plugs. We have a website. There's some stuff on it. I don't know. Johnny does some podcasts. We'll be here next week.
Hey, peace. You could review the show on iTunes. That would be awesome.
Oh, God, we haven't done that one in a while.
Yeah.
We have an email address. We talk about it in other episodes. You can probably find it.
Yeah, it's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com.
It's almost like I listened to the show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing plugs anymore.
We're also on Twitter. Johnny is at Johnny Metz.
Oh, we're doing the Twitter plugs. God.
Why not? Why not? Mr. Diamond J, M-R, D-I-A-M-O-N-D-J. And Guy is Guillaume_NWR.
There's no underscore.
No underscore?
Guillaume NWR.
So there you go. And James, what's yours? It's James something or other?
NWR_James. I'm also going to change it to you in the shower.
Mm-hmm. Mine's going to be changed to grooming ritual.
Yep.
I'm not changing mine to infanticide. Go fuck yourself.
Jeez. Are you sure?
Yes, I'm pretty sure.
You're pretty sure. So we're saying you got a chance.
So next week
there's
when we
a chance.
This plug, you guys going, actually,
this might have to twist your arm a little bit.
Keep your plugs away from the shower. Thanks for listening, everybody. We out.
Peace.
Bye.
Later.